Hello and welcome to our CrossCast webinar series. My name is Katie Turner. I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at Cross Financial. Today's topic, Proactive Quality of Life Planning, guest hosted by Ann Kerner, founder and CEO of National Care Advisors. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback. And now let's get to today's presentation, and I'll turn it over to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Katie, and thank you to Cross Financials for inviting me to speak today. Today, we're going to be talking about proactive quality of life planning and basically a three-prong approach that we feel works most effectively for families that have any type of special needs challenge. One of the things that we always like to kind of start out with is the fact that special needs is not just developmental disability. And by developmental disability, we mean families that are touched by loved ones that have Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or autism or any other kind of intellectual disability. Here at National Care Advisors, we define special needs as basically anyone who needs help from someone else to achieve their quality of life. So that includes individuals who have mental illness, may have physical disability, may have been in a car accident, traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, and elder care as well. Very often, certainly for those of us that serve families, you realize really quickly that first of all, disability does not discriminate, and secondarily, that it is rare to have just one problem in a family. Often we have a child, an adult child with a special need, and then we may also have elder care issues for mom and dad. And so this planning process becomes a little bit more complex. It's not just one person we're planning for, it's the family situation we're planning for. And I think best practices says that we take a look at everybody's quality of life, not just the individual who has the special need. So today we're going to talk a little bit about National Care Advisors, but also best practices, essential components of quality of life vision, accomplishing the vision, and implementing the plan. You might wonder, how come I was chosen to speak here? And so National Care Advisors is a national nurse consulting firm, and we provide life care planning, quality of life assessment, cost analysis, benefits management, and case management services in all 50 states. We are working with up to 900 families a month, so significant amounts of client base, which gives us data to, and also we've been following those families for years now as the company was founded in 2008. So some of the folks that were children when we started are now grown, very grown adults. And so we now can see if our planning process works. And I have to say, I'm very, very proud of the fact that we know that this best practice actually does work. It's important to know too, National Care Advisors, we don't practice law and we don't sell financial products or services of any kind. We are just nurse case managers, and we also have education consultants as well for our children that are under age 22. What that does is allows us to be 100% objective. We are looking at just what is in the best interest of those families, and we bill hourly for that service. And again, we're looking at folks that have complex care needs, as I mentioned, regardless of their diagnosis. We're really looking and focusing on functional ability, not diagnosis. So a goal without a plan is just a wish. So let's just start with some of what we feel here at National Care Advisors are the best practices. The very first step is to help that family define their vision for care and quality of life. I must say that this is often overlooked. A lot of times we jump into how much money, or what do you want your legal documents to say, or who's going to be the successor, but we haven't actually talked through what is the vision for care and quality of life. Not just today, but let's talk 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years down the road. And oftentimes families get stuck. Parents definitely get stuck. We know as nurses, because we work with clients of all ages with varying degrees of functional disability and different types of diagnoses, what does that child with Down syndrome look like when they're 50? What does that young adult who's 20 with autism need when they're 65? We have a good idea based on functional ability at the time we do this initial life care plan to be quite objective in projecting what those care needs and potentially increased care needs will be as the individual ages. Also, I would have to say that most of us have a really hard time imagining ourselves as 75, 85, 95, depending on the longevity in your family. And so we often, part of that vision includes when the child with autism or Down syndrome is 50, what age is mom and dad? Frequently 80, 85 years old. What is going to be need their support and quality of life? And how are they going to get that done? The second step is analyzing the costs related to that vision. And that's real life costs in today's dollars. As I mentioned before, we're nurses. We are not economists or financial gurus, but I can tell you that if you wanted to fund a certain vision for care and quality of life today, our nurses, and depending on where your community is, depending on what your benefits are, we'll be able to tell you what those real life costs are in today's dollars related to that vision. Often it means that we have to then revise the vision, because sometimes the vision for care and quality of life exceeds the amount of resources. Other times we're helping parents to realize that, oh no, they could actually have a better vision for care and quality of life than what they've had today, essentially giving them permission to spend, depending on their financial situation. And that's where, again, that three-pronged approach with having the financial advisor, the legal expert, and the care manager involved leads to a better quality of life plan. We also identify payer sources to provide funds for the costs. There's really no magic here. When you're looking at a quality of life plan, there's only three ways to get it accomplished from a very practical, pragmatic approach: unpaid family time, energy, and love, third-party benefits, and then private family funding or resources. We often find that parents have not maximized or do not fully understand how to which third-party benefits are going to be available to their loved one and what is going to be the value of those benefits over lifetime, not just today, but over lifetime. Also, we really want to involve family members to understand if we're expecting unpaid family time, energy, and love, let's make sure the successors actually are on board with that. We cannot make assumptions about that. So that's super important. And then, of course, so important to consult with a financial planner relative to private family funding. We then want to talk about key life transitions. Again, as I said, with the aging process, heaven forbid there's the loss of a key parent or caregiver or disability of that key parent or caregiver, family caregiver. The next thing is we get down the road, once we've figured out what the plan is and we figured out what the costs are and we've applied the value of benefits to that, we want to document that plan, and we recommend that best practices to review annually. Pick a day, I don't know. The afternoon of January 1st is always a good time. But to take a look, the family should take a look at it, because our crystal ball gets a little cloudy after a year. So we want to be able to adjust that plan. There might be a change in a benefit. There might be a change in the health of a key caregiver. There might be a change in the functional ability of the actual family member that has the special need. We want to make sure that we've revised that plan and made the adjustments necessary, whether they're financial, whether it's legal, again, whether it's a care need. And so doing it annually, we're never more than a year off. And we have found, again, over the last 15, 16 years of doing this, that actually serves the family incredibly well, because it is a flexible plan. Absolutely have to have legal services to create the documents that will ensure that the plan is actually followed and implemented by the successors. So very important to have that key professional involved. And then also to make sure that we have a good quality financial planner involved to ensure that the funding is actually consistent with the plan and available at the time that it's needed. So that's where, when we're talking about some types of products like annuities or other types of things that we commonly see, we want to make sure that the money's available at the time it's needed and that we didn't push it out too far. And then the final step is to actually share the plan with the successors. Doesn't mean you have to share the legal documents or the funding streams or just how much the estate has in it. But if you're expecting the next generation to be participating in, even as an advisor for that loved one with special needs, we call those dining room table discussions. And it's very important that they understand that, first of all, one of the best gifts a parent can give to their other children is to do this planning process, not only share their vision, get the legal documents in order, and the financial funding streams in order. What a gift to the next generation who is going to take over for the care and love and quality of life for that family member with special needs. So, the essential components of the quality of life vision. Certainly medical care, that's a no-brainer, that's easy. Actually for us as nurses, we can solve that problem pretty easy. The second is the custodial personal care and supervision. I will tell you that almost every parent that we work with underestimates the value of their services to their special needs child. And sometimes they think, who is that one person that's going to take over for me when I can't care for my loved one anymore? The answer is often it's not going to be one person. It may be several people, and they may not do things exactly as you like, but by documenting the vision, at least we'll be pretty darn close. Supplies and equipment that may or may not be, that's of course important for folks that have functional disability as far as physical disability, and they need, you know, wheelchairs or an accommodated home or those kinds of things. And we need to schedule to replace those, especially if the quality of the equipment is not 100% covered by insurance. Housing. We talk at length about housing. I am sure some of you may have been in a position where parents have said, I think that my special needs loved one, my child, my adult child, I want them to stay in the family home for the rest of all time. I will say that is not always a really sound plan, because if the special needs individual is not capable of understanding things like gutters need to be cleaned out, what happens if there's a plumbing emergency on Sunday evening? What happens, how do you turn on and off the thermostat for air conditioning and heat? Even very high functioning individuals, I can tell you some horror stories of adult children with special needs that remained in a family home without appropriate management and supervision. In one case, quite literally in Ohio, we had an adult child, both parents passed away suddenly. And this young man did not understand that you had to slip the button from air conditioning to heat. A neighbor found him in November in a freezing cold house because he didn't know how to turn the heat on and he didn't know to ask the neighbor. The parents had made no plan. By the way, the parents had a couple million in their estate plan, but seriously did not understand the functional ability of their son, and thought that if they left the house to him, everything would be just fine. I wish I could say that was a one-off story, but it's not. Transportation is also something that's often missed in quality of life vision, and parents don't really understand the value of their time to transport. So often we have programs for young adults with special needs, but the transportation involves perhaps mom or dad interrupting their day at 9 and 3 to get them there for the rest of all time, if they're not using other types of transportation sources, or transportation to doctor's appointments, or transportation for holidays to join other family members. What happens when mom or dad are no longer there? So we wanna make sure that we've included the costs and also the actual custodial care or driver service that might be needed. Vocational support. Oftentimes we do have high functioning individuals with special needs that are capable of working in a supported role. However, mom and dad are, again, helping them make sure they get up on time, get to work on time, have the right clothing on, navigating the schedule, navigating issues with their bosses. If that is being done by family members or parents, in the event that they're no longer available, we're going to need to provide a service for that. socialization support. This is often missed as well. We often see that individuals with special needs, their socialization is very much involved with their parents. We know that that adult is going to outlive their parents. And so what are they going to do all day? What are they going to do at the holidays? What are those things that mom and dad are providing that have value that have not actually cost any out-of-pocket money, but we need to consider as we're doing our quality of life vision plan and the cost associated with it. And then other specific quality of life factors. National Care Advisors works primarily in the with clients that have disposable income and in the wealth arena for the most part. In most cases, we get things like, I still want my child to be able to take a vacation, but we know that they must have a companion to go on vacation. It is super important that we just had a child with, well, adult child with autism whose family was like, they need to be able to ski at Tahoe because that brings pleasure to them. And so we put that into the quality of life vision, including the costs of equipment, the costs of the lift pass, the cost of the lift pass for the companion that has to go with him. You get my drift on that. Basically, specific quality of life factors. Oh, one other is participation in perhaps religious services. We had one family that said that they wanted to make sure that their son still had all of the support and resources to attend temple every Saturday for the rest of his life. And so it was very important that we made sure that that was in the directives, number one, but also that we had a caregiver that was going to make sure that that directive was followed through. And so that this young man could still participate in his religious activities as the family defined their quality of life. So those things are often missed, and they're often missed by other professionals that are working with families and don't put all of those things and quantify the costs that are related to them when family caregivers are no longer available on an unpaid basis. So as I mentioned, there's nice to have and gotta haves. Often the vision is a little higher than what the resources are, especially when you consider mom and dad's elder care needs. And so we work with the family, the financial planner, collaboratively to make sure that that plan is within scope of the available resources, net of any third-party benefits. So, as I mentioned before, and I'm saying it again because it's so important, we have families that get stuck. And, you know, this is not as complicated as you think. And so we don't have to have all the answers today. We need to have the answers as they exist today, knowing that we're going to look at this annually and be able to update it as new information comes into us over time. So the only three ways to get the vision accomplished: private family individual funds, unpaid family time and energy, and third-party benefits. So it is important also to kind of take a look at the timeline for planning. And I did borrow this from another financial planner, so he gave me permission for it. But in any case, as you kind of look at a traditional planning timeline for someone who doesn't have any special needs, you know, you're looking at the transition from childhood to adulthood, and then you're looking at the transitions that occur at retirement. Well, for individuals with special needs, often that timeline is a little different. Certainly, we work with clients from birth until death. And so early stage one, we want to really take a look at, first of all, getting a solid diagnosis, but then any kind of early intervention services and waiver programs that might be available, regardless of mom and dad's income and assets, by the way. At age three, public education benefits come in play. Those are federally guaranteed. They should be the same in all states, although sometimes it takes some advocacy to get those accomplished. But the child is available for early intervention, individual education plan services at age three. And often that is missed. Parents don't take advantage. That would include therapies, developmental specialists and education specialists. So we give these children a head start when they actually get into kindergarten or first grade. The next stage is transition planning, and we like to say it starts really, really early. I will say, based on the public federal benefits, education benefits, it is mandated to start at age 15. This is when the individual education plan starts to talk about goals for employment or meaningful activity as an adult if the individual is not able to be employed with supports. We talk about where the individual is going to live, who's going to provide custodial care support. What does that plan look like? And if a family would like to transition to independent living at that age, age 15 is not too early to get them on wait lists, because for the really good options for supported community living, you need to be on a wait list, because either private pay or government supported, the wait lists are pretty significant for the best options. And so age 15, 16 is when we start to not only explore that, but also to get that young adult on the wait list. At age 18, this is a critical time, and we often see families and parents leave benefits on the table. Supplemental security income, that's Social Security benefit. Now, mom and dad have probably paid into Social Security since the time they started working. If that child meets the disability criteria at age 18, mom and dad's income and assets no longer are a factor. And Social Security, supplemental security income, depending on which state you're in, is either worth about $943 a month, that's a lot of money to leave on the table, or if you're in California or some other states with a state supplement, it can be well over $1,000 a month. Why would you leave that on the table? You want to talk about guardianship or conservatorship at age 18 if the individual is not capable of managing their own affairs, or power of attorney if they're high functioning. They don't meet the criteria for guardianship or conservatorship, but 18 is the time when we need to do that. Otherwise, they run the risk, heaven forbid there's an accident, the individual with the special needs arrives in the emergency room, there is the risk that parents will not be able to make healthcare decisions if we have not addressed that after age 18. With supplemental security income comes Medicaid. Even for our wealthy clients, we sometimes do opt to tap into the Medicaid system for several reasons. The Medicaid system is the only government-funded system in the United States that provides significant resources for the cost of long-term custodial care. In addition, Medicaid will coordinate with private health insurance to pay co-pays and the 20% and the deductible that private health insurance won't pay for. We also want to talk about college, and for, again, our high functioning children with special needs, there are some wonderful adaptive supported college programs, sometimes vocationally focused, sometimes just continued adult learning. But for families that are interested in that, there are some wonderful, wonderful programs. We also find that when children that are high functioning with special needs do progress to college and perhaps live in a dorm with appropriate supports, they develop skills that they will never develop in mom and dad's home, because as parents, we just anticipate our kids' needs. Then we talk about that actual final transition to adulthood. For the general population, we tend to think of our kids as being fairly self-supporting by 22, 23, 24, somewhere in that ballpark. At least that's the goal for most of us who are parents of children. For children that have special needs, we often give them a few extra years for maturity. And so we really say to parents, you're going to know what you've got when your kid is probably 25 to 28, maybe 30 even. They'll still be gaining skills, independence, and you can really finally say, you know what, this is what it is when they're in the 25 to 28 year range. At that point, there's decisions to be made about residence, employment, social and recreation, and certainly other benefits that might be available to them so that they can achieve their best possible quality of life. And often at that point, when we start getting into the 30s and 40s, sometimes we have parents that are either disabled themselves or are starting to look at retirement. And so then we're looking at those dependent benefits through Social Security, which, by the way, are not income and asset dependent, and do not take away from the parent's Social Security benefit, and are available at the minute that parent starts drawing their own Social Security benefit, whether retirement or disability. Those benefits can be high as $1,500, $1,800 a month, not something to be left on the table, although we see that very commonly. We have a retired parent For whatever reason, Social Security didn't realize they had an adult disabled child. And when you do finally catch it, they'll go back a year or two, but they won't go back to the time that the parent actually started drawing those benefits. Same with SSI. We very commonly see parents don't understand the value of SSI. They may delay applying for it until the child's like 30. Social Security is not going to go back to age 18. They'll go back a couple years, but they're not going to go back to the beginning of all time. And sometimes there's significant funds left on the table from Social Security benefits that I guarantee you, mom and dad, the taxpayers have paid in. Also, we wanted in adulthood, I kind of skipped over here, but is self-employment of the individual with the special need. There are very special, somewhat complicated ticket to work and other kinds of work programs through Social Security so that an individual with special needs or with disability can work. However, they can offset their wages based on the supportive care needs. That includes transportation and other things that are required to enable them to work. And so they can still have the best of all worlds. We can preserve their Social Security benefit, we can preserve their Medicaid benefit, and they're able to work and have gainful income because of these programs. Generally, that does require some help for a parent to navigate that. I would like to say that the social service agencies are good at that, not always. And then we start to look at retirement of the parent and the lifetime supplemental needs. Mom and dad are usually supplementing care and quality of life. They might be buying clothing, they're providing vehicles, they're paying for caregivers privately. We need to know what that number is so that we can continue to make sure that a number is available even after mom and dad are no longer here. And then finally, the remainder interests and how that might be funded. And certainly the lawyers are going to be talking about different estate plans, different types of trusts based on the amount of funds that the family, the resources that the family has, how important is it to preserve access to Social Security, like supplemental security income or Medicaid for this individual. Also, there may be other programs that require that the individual be in the Medicaid system to maximize the benefit. So sometimes, even though we're not really, Medicaid might not be super important to the individual, we still may recommend a special needs trust. But we want to be talking to the attorney before that decision is made relative to the vision and the community services that make a difference to that particular individual's quality of life. So when the attorney makes a particular estate recommendation, that they have all the information they need to make sure that that recommendation is as sound as possible and considers not only today's vision, but the vision over time. One other thing is that at the time of the parent's retirement or when they start being eligible for Medicare, when that child with the disability, adult child, begins receiving dependent Social Security benefits, within 2 years, they will also be eligible for Medicare, and then they'll be dual eligible. They'll have both Medicare and Medicaid, and quite frankly, that's the golden goose in the United States today. There's very little that we can't accomplish with both Medicare and Medicaid benefits in place. So I've kind of jumped into the benefits and carrying those benefits over lifetime. We always, of course, want to talk about income sources and pensions. If you have a client that's got a particularly complex pension, like perhaps they were a public employee or a teacher, it's really important that there's some guidance given to the parents about how they take that pension. Is there a way to allow that pension to continue to be available to their dependent child? Certainly VA benefits, that's another area that are very complex. We at National Care Advisors often consult with financial planners and attorneys to make sure that we've quantified what that benefit looks like for that adult disabled child after mom and dad are no longer available. And can we get health insurance or even custodial care services, depending on when that child was declared to be disabled? Oftentimes these benefits will continue beyond the lifetime of the adult. You'll see Medi-Cal. Medi-Cal is just the California term for Medicaid, so I apologize for that. But we want to look at health insurance sources, Medicaid, Medicare, and Affordable Care Act insurance, what those costs are. We can quantify the cost of Affordable Care Act insurance in all 50 states at this point. There is no reason anywhere in the United States for an individual not to be insured at this time. I can tell you that we have no problem since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act finding insurance for every single client at National Care Advisors, often with subsidies because, again, once the individual's over 18, mom and dad's income and assets are no longer a factor. It's only the income of the individual with the special need. We also, before we turn our back on government benefits, we want to be able to quantify those benefits. Regional center is developmental disability services, and those developmental disability services, while there may be wait lists for waivers, not all states are funded equally. Certainly, we like to say the worse the weather, the better the benefits. So Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, even Illinois has much better benefits than Florida, Arizona, Texas. And so that also helps to inform life transitions. If we're going to move to a warmer climate upon retirement, let's make sure we go in with our eyes wide open that perhaps a benefit that was available in Pennsylvania or Ohio will not be available in Florida or Arizona, depending on where the parents want to retire. And then, of course, nonprofit resources. We're finding more and more there's programs that are out there. We certainly have relationships with many, many nonprofit resources, and there's a lot of help out there if you're looking for it. And we want to make sure that we're not doing something inadvertently to skewer that benefit, number one, but also that if we're relying on a nonprofit resource for an essential service, that that is in the vision and that the successors know it. So when you're looking at a quality of life plan, it's all about the custodial care. I'm going to let you guys do the math, but right now, since COVID, in order to hire a quality home health aide or custodial care provider, assuming that the individual needs 24/7 supervision, cannot stay home alone overnight, you're looking at a minimum of $20 to $25 an hour for that individual. And if you're going through an agency, it's going to be more like $37 to $40 an hour. Do the math, 24 hours a day times 7 days a week, 365 days a year, is a huge amount of money, even for our most wealthy clients. And so it's super important that we don't inadvertently turn our back on means-tested benefits. And I often do have to have a discussion with attorneys and financial planners when they say, oh, Medicaid's not important to this family. If they have not done the calculation of what the value of Medicaid and developmental disability services is to offset at least a portion of the custodial care costs, I think that they're giving some advice that is not well-founded. Preserving access does not mean you have to actually use Medicaid, by the way. Medicaid will never force you to use Medicaid. In all cases, you can say to the Medicaid system, look, I'm not happy with the quality of the service, or I'm not happy with the vendor and I want to pay privately. I will tell you that in my considerable 30-year experience as a nurse case manager, I've never had Medicaid come back and say, oh, you must use Medicaid. Now, there is a rule that says if Medicaid will pay, let's say $16 an hour to a provider, you can't give them the other $9 an hour. So we have to be a little creative, and we use our Medicaid dollars for some of the hours of the day, and then we may have to pay a premium hourly rate to a caregiver and average it so that we can find individuals who are willing to work for our clients. There's a lot of very interesting techniques that we use to maximize benefits and still stay within the rules and not get anyone upset. One of the other things that's important for families to know, that if indeed a trustee ultimately takes over to provide staffing for custodial care, they cannot pay on a cash basis. There is a huge market in the United States for custodial care, the home health aid services. Many, many, many families pay cash. We're not following labor laws. We're not paying overtime. We're not doing a lot of things. That all changes when a trustee takes over. A trustee will insist on following the labor laws, so that $20 to $25 an hour must be increased to consider employer taxes, workers' comp and other types of considerations to follow the labor laws. And so oftentimes that's a calculation we will include in our quality of life vision cost analysis. So in most Medicaid programs are income and asset restricted in most states, except for California. I don't know if you have all heard this, but in California, there is no longer an asset test for Medicaid programs for in-home support services and skilled nursing facilities. So it has really changed the way we look at elderly clients that may have relatively, you know, like the asset of the home or the asset of, you know, a 401k or, you know, those kinds of things. In California, this is a really new starting January 2024, where there's absolutely no asset restriction for any of the Medicaid programs. One of the other things to understand is that Medicaid is a umbrella of programs. You cannot assume because you understand one area of Medicaid that you understand all areas of Medicaid. Many Medicaid programs have different income and asset restrictions depending on the program, and it is absolutely state specific, which is one thing that kind of drives a lot of financial planners and families crazy, because what you know in your state when that person, that family decides to relocate, or that individual needs to relocate to a different state because of a successor caregiver situation, you cannot assume that what's happening in their home state will be available in the state that they move to. The disability criteria are basically the same across the nation because the federal government defines that. Although even that's not the same for developmental disability services. In some states, there's a hard and fast rule about IQ. In other states, it might be you have to have deficits in 3 of 5 functional areas. So for developmental disability services, Medicaid programs are funded both with federal funds and state funds, and they are administered at the state level. One of the other interesting differences is that you could have home care services in one state authorized. For example, it's not uncommon that we can get 8 hours a day through a Medicaid waiver program for long-term care support. And you move to another state that doesn't have the same level of funding, they still are eligible for benefits. The individual's eligible for benefits, but instead of 8 hours a day, they only get 4 hours a day. And so again, we have to advocate and see what we can do, but a lot of times our hands are tied on that. On the other side though, if you can get 8 hours a day paid through the government, that's 30% of the cost of custodial care, 33 1/3%. Why would you leave that on the table? That is huge. So we wanna make sure that we've quantified these programs. They're super important. And there's also elder care programs for some of our clients that make a difference. Sometimes we have wealth that is not available to all members in the family. And so, but maybe that one of those individuals is actually still going to need care. So we want to make sure that we're coming up with a vision for care and quality of life that considers the entire family situation. And finally, at end of life care, as much as we all say, I don't think I've ever worked with a client who said, boy, I hope I die in a skilled nursing facility. Everybody says, I'm never going to a nursing home. The reality is that statistically, many of us will indeed require skilled nursing facility care at the very end of life. Facility-based Medicaid can be very valuable to a family situation. And so we want to make sure that we have considered that and whether or not we need to preserve access. Doesn't mean you'll definitely use it, but do we want to preserve access in case that is needed at very end of life care? By the way, Medicare does not provide long-term care. It's very important. And hospice Medicare benefits do not provide 24/7 care at end of life. As I mentioned before, the VA administration benefits have income and asset restrictions sometimes for eligibility. The VA system does have home care, assisted living, and skilled nursing facility benefits. Really needs to be quantified before you make some kind of a determination about providing somebody with income or assigning an asset to them if you haven't already quantified whether there's a VA benefit available. Long-term care insurance, always interesting. We get this question a lot from people that are already been diagnosed with something. And the bottom line is, many of you may already know, long-term care insurance, if you're over 55 and have already had a diagnosis of, let's say, MS or early dementia or cancer, there's nobody that's going to insure you. So if you didn't have the foresight to know that was going to happen, you're kind of out of luck. We do commonly find clients that have long-term care insurance. They did have the foresight to purchase it, or it was provided through their employer as a benefit, and they're leaving money on the table because they don't think they qualify quite yet. So it's super important to understand the requirements to start benefits. You have to have a physician certification. There's going to be an independent nursing evaluation. You have to have benefits in a certain number of functional abilities. You need to understand the duration of the benefits, the daily limitations. Some of them are lifetime benefit limited. So it might say, you know, when you hit a certain dollar amount, you're done. Other, it's time. So it's important to understand when to start that benefit. So, you know, at the end of 3 years, you're done, no more support. And then the daily amount limitations, some of these policies we see have a cost of living adjustment, others do not. And oftentimes these policies are written to reimburse the family. So they have to have the amount of money, they have to have money available to pay the service provider, usually it's a home care provider, and then they get reimbursed. And we have had problems sometimes, again, because we don't have cash, we don't have liquidity, even though we've got a really good long-term care insurance policy, because the long-term care insurance policy will not reimburse the vendor. They'll only reimburse the individual who is the beneficiary. We also have trouble with long-term care insurance frequently because they have some silly rules regarding their releases so that other people can help them. And we often have to kind of fight with the insurance company to say, look, the client's got dementia. You must talk to either the spouse or a child, you know, an adult child or a case manager, and getting them to get those releases signed can be challenging. So we often do help with implementing long-term care insurance. If both spouses have long-term care insurance, we really do take a solid look at staggering the start so that we have maybe instead of 3 years, 6 years of insurance. As much as the statistic says that you're only going to need 3 years of help before you die, I'm going to tell you that that's a statistic on average, and we certainly have lots and lots of clients that need well more than 3 years of help in their elder care years. And then as financial planners, I'm sure they can do the cost versus the benefit for those premiums over lifetime. There's, of course, always lots of discussion. The premiums seem very high. Are you going to be able to use it? Is it better to self-insure? That is outside of my pay grade as a nurse. All I can tell you is what I think the cost of care will be, and then what is the value of an insurance policy that might be considered to cover a portion of those costs. So there's also some Medicare savings assistance programs for folks that have low income and assets. It's important to mention those because sometimes with inheritance, we knock people off those benefits. These programs will assist with the cost of Part B Medicare insurance, which is mandatory. They'll also cover, they'll give the individual access to Medicaid in some cases. And they have higher income and higher asset levels than Medicaid, just straight Medicaid. Not that you need to know them in any kind of specific way, but we do sometimes look at that when we have someone who's dual eligible or that just has Medicare but has not tapped into these systems. If any of you have retired recently and you're 65 and you happen to have a fairly high income and you've looked at your Medicare Part B premium, you may have been shocked because in many cases it's very, very high if you have significant income. And so that's just something to keep in the back of your mind. If there's a family member who's low income, again, mom and dad's income and assets do not transfer to a child over age 18. So how do we get this plan done? We're going to document it. We're going to collaborate with other professionals, and we're going to use the best of their knowledge with the best of the case management and care management consulting knowledge that we have. We're going to collaborate with a qualified attorney and financial planner, and we're going to share the plan with the successors so that there's not a crisis when someone either becomes disabled or is no longer with us, is deceased. We're for concierge care here at National Care Advisors. We don't go away. We're available on an as-needed basis. So families can hire us to do a task or not hire us to do a task. We'll give recommendations for specialists and therapists and equipment and supplies. We'll establish and manage home care services, including doing the search, vetting for home health aides, narrowing it down to two or three people, and then having the family make the final decision on who they'd like to hire. We can help with transition to assisted living or other alternative home settings, and commonly get asked to assist with elder care transitions, especially when the adult children know that that transition needs to happen and the parents are a little resistant. And also to work through quality of life considerations, especially, you know, high-end vacations, with making sure all the supplies and equipment and a caregiver is available when you get to your destination. We can do all kinds of things to, you name it, you probably can't stump us here at National Care Advisors. We can get it done. We also manage and maximize third-party benefits, either by supporting the parents and explaining it to them, or the successor guardians or conservators or advisors or trustees, just making sure that we haven't left any money on the table from a third-party benefit that may have quite a bit of support. Certainly supporting successor generation guardians and primary family care managers so they're not deer in the headlights when they have to take over for their parents. Certainly, we provide advisor services. Sometimes families choose to have us be an advisor on a trust advisory committee for a trustee, for a corporate trustee, and consulting regarding the needed for supported decision making or guardian or conservative protection. And then problem solving, just finding solutions. That is actually one of the core services of National Care Advisors. And even if it's not us, finding those trusted professionals to work within your team is very, very important. You need to have your go-to team to find solutions for your clients. Might not be within your professional expertise, but it is my professional opinion that you need to have a super sound referral source to make sure that you're not leaving your families high and dry for areas that their solutions do exist. So a goal without a plan is just a wish. I'm more than happy to take some questions. I absolutely appreciate your time today and would be happy to spend a few minutes answering questions if that's appropriate.
Unfortunately, we don't have too much time for questions today, but any questions that do have come in, we will make sure to follow up with you later this week. A recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your Attorney Access account. If you haven't already created an account, head over to MedicaidAnnuity.com/join to get started. Signing up is quick, easy, and free, and gives you access to all of our latest educational content and Medicaid planning resources. Thank you again, Anne, for your great presentation, and thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon, everyone.
Thank you so much.